Sports bettors, Circa Sports now presents Palm Saturdays with Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm. Live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Here on 104.3 The Score. And watch live on YouTube and Twitch. Featuring the latest and the greatest of the sports betting landscape from coast to coast, along with some great guests. Here he is, Mike Palm.
Good Saturday morning, coming to you from beautiful downtown Las Vegas. Good morning, Chicago. Big show on Tap Youth Day. That's right, we're live for the next hour, right up to inside the clubhouse with David Haw and Bruce Levine. You know, I planned this show out. I knew in my heart of hearts Max Crosby was not going to remain a Raider. I don't know too many folks out here in Las Vegas that thought he was going to stay with the organization. And the betting markets moved so much this week in favor of the Chicago Bears to the point where they were a $2 favorite to be the next team. Max Crosby takes a snap for. Some of that is his relationship with Caleb Williams. He appeared on Williams' podcast. It seemed like he was amenable to coming to Chicago. The Bears have a need for another edge rusher. But you have to remember in these markets as well, it's not like an NFL game or even a college basketball game, a Power Four game that we'll play today where you're going to write somewhere between $50,000 and $150,000 on it. This kind of a market, you know, you might not write $20,000 on. So a couple guys make a max bet for $1,000, that moves the money pretty quickly. So I planned this out. We have a relationship with Crosby because of Circa, and he's come down here to hang out in the off season a couple times, come down for different events, so know him and his agent. So I thought, boy, if this news can break right yesterday that he's come to the Bears, we could have him on the program this morning. Well, didn't break soon enough to begin with, and then when it broke, it was that Max Crosby was going to the Baltimore Ravens for two first-round picks. Nevertheless, we will have Ben Wilson join the show here in about 20 minutes. Up-and-coming young play-by-play announcer. You may have heard him doing college basketball, college baseball, arena football, soccer. He's terrific. A better as well. He's from Milwaukee. So we'll get his insights on the college basketball landscape. Indian Wells, he's a prolific tennis better coming up. Maybe some soccer picks and some college baseball leans. All right, back to the Bears. Now, you know, pretty, I would say, almost unanimously, the move they made to ship DJ Moore to the Bills was seen as very positive. I'm reading the grades on this. The grades are anywhere from an A. The worst grade I've seen on this, I think, is a B. And I would say a consensus grade is either an A or an A minus on this move. Well, it's good for several reasons, obviously. They got a second-round pick back. I saw one guy say, oh, you should have gotten more for DJ Moore. I don't think so. I really don't think so. To get a second-round pick in 2026, I think, was commensurate with what his value was. You'd like to maybe cleared up more cap space, but you do clear up $16.5 million in cap space to make the move. Obviously, Moore's production had waned last year. He had career lows in receiving yards and receptions, and it seemed to wane a little bit more as the season went on and as they got into the playoffs. I do think that, listen, with Burden, with Adunze, with the two tight ends, with a couple of backs that can catch the ball, you know, there's only so many passes that you can throw in your offense. And I do think these young and upcoming receivers should get featured more. Now, here's the drawback to this side of it. You need to have a veteran in that receiver room. You can't have everybody that's in their rookie, their first, second, or even their third year. And I learned that from working with Mike Pritchard on VSiN, just a terrific human being. But you know, Mike Pritchard played 9 years in the NFL. He was a first-round draft pick out of Colorado. Supposedly won a national championship. We'll get with Lou Holtz later in the year on the clipping call on the Rocket Ishmael. A punt return touchdown in the Orange Bowl, but Colorado won a national championship with Mike Roger, with Mike Pritchard, and he played for the Falcons, the Broncos, and the Seahawks in his career. And stressed about the importance of a veteran voice in these receiver rooms. You know, these teams huddle by position groups, and you need leadership at each position group. So there is something to that, and whether the Bears acquire a journeyman to fill out their roster at receiver, we'll see if that happens. Drew Dolman retires unexpectedly. The Bears quickly went out and addressed that and went and got Garrett Bradbury, who, of course, played at NC State, and then spent the first 5 years of his career with the Vikings, and then New England had signed him last year to a two-year deal for $12 million. So they get Bradbury. He's under contract for 1 year. I think this was a terrific move as an immediate replacement to the center position. He started every game for them, including the Super Bowl, and so another good move by the Bears here. They released Tremaine Edmonds, the linebacker. That clears almost as much cap space as DJ Moore did. That's another $15 million in cap space. So obviously the thought was they're making room for Crosby. What would they have had to give up? If it was two first-rounders, I agree. It wasn't the move. I don't think everybody was all in on Crosby being in Chicago. I know my good friend Tina Wynn, who was on the program a couple weeks ago, her and I talked this week. She wasn't 100% sold on it and rightfully brings up 8 surgeries in 7 seasons. And you look at his sack numbers, he's the 4th best pass rusher in the league. Maybe he's the 5th, the 6th. He's certainly not the best. He is an intangible guy, and from being around here in Las Vegas, that was certainly true. But the Bears need more than one position on the defensive side of the ball. They probably need to fill 3, maybe 4, including a couple on the defensive line. So I think that the moves this week for the Bears, when you take them in their totality, I would give this the grade of an A. And I'm generally a harsh grader. Maybe you could say an A-. My good friend David Haw, I listened to him yesterday, and you know, he brings up a concern about are Bears fans prisoners of the moment in judging DJ Moore's tenure in Chicago based on his perceived lack of effort or hustle on the interception in the playoff game? Is that unfair? Yeah. You're right. I don't know if that's going to be the lasting memory of DJ Moore. Maybe it's the memory in the moment. David has to be careful. He might be coming upon a conflict of interest. He can't be Ben Johnson and DJ Moore's agent at the same time, although maybe he can now that they're in different organizations. And I say that kiddingly and lovingly. But I understand his perspective. But look where DJ Moore was in his tenure here and how clutch he was in years past. And you know, I remember when they were 0-4 and playing the Washington team on Monday Night Football, and he sort of single-handedly lifted them to their first victory, what was that, about 3 years ago. So I don't think anyone will forget the value that DJ Moore had. And look, I don't, you know, you say this is an A or an A-minus trade for the Bears. That necessarily means it can't be that good for Buffalo. They're getting the short end of it. I don't know. I mean, they need a receiver. They're willing to take a shot. The Bears are still picking up, obviously, a big part of his contract, and maybe for some people, a new setting, a fresh face in a new place changes perspective. So I don't think it's that big of a stretch for the Bills to take that shot. We also had yesterday the end of the NHL trade deadline. You're listening to Palm Saturdays here on The Score. You can catch the live stream of this on both Twitch and YouTube. I saw that this week, looked at some of the episodes. And of course, if you can't listen live or if you want to go back and listen on demand, you can go to the Odyssey website. Trade deadline came and went for the NHL. It was a little unique this year in that it was split into two parts because of the Olympic break. And there's plenty to talk about there. If we want to address the Blackhawks first off, and what they did or what they didn't do. They traded center Jason Dixon and the forward Colton Dock to Edmonton. They made two moves with Edmonton. Earlier in the week, they sent Connor Murphy there for a 2028 second-round pick. And then Dixon and Dock for a conditional first-round pick next year and Andrew Mangiapane. Now, Mangiapane is interesting. Because your memories of him are probably in his productive years in Calgary. Not so productive this past year with the Oilers, certainly in a different situation, but if he can live back up to what he did in his days in Calgary, certainly could be an interesting piece for the Hawks moving forward. So they compile another first-round pick for 27, a second-round pick in 28. They sent Foligno to Minnesota for future considerations. And then the one deal that I wasn't so gung-ho about or understood necessarily was sending a prospect to the Rangers and Aiden Thompson to get a 32-year-old defenseman. I'm not sure Pouliot will be a part of the rebuild in Chicago or if it's a short-term solution or not. So I'll pass on that. Obviously, Kyle Davidson and the Blackhawks are telling you we're continuing to stockpile draft capital, perhaps to make a move with later or perhaps to take some swings in the draft to build this team. But the plan continues to move along that I think next year you have to have the expectation they're going to compete for a playoff spot. There were guys out there to get on teams that were selling. I don't know that they wanted to give up any of this draft capital to go and get them, but at some point you have to start building around Connor Bedard. And I do keep drawing the comparison between San Jose and Macklin Celebrini and the Blackhawks and Bedard. Obviously, San Jose, way ahead of schedule, and probably will make the playoffs this year and have signaled to everybody they're out of sell mode and they're into competing now mode, where the Blackhawks are still sell and build for the future. The Hawks do have now 5 first-rounders and 7 second-rounders over the next 3 years. Let's talk a little bit about the trade deadline in general. Look, the teams at the top, specifically Colorado, specifically Minnesota, Dallas, they didn't stand pat. They're continued to move to try to win now and win this year. I think Bill Guerin in Minnesota sort of forced the hands of the other teams in that division. It's easy to make the argument the best three teams are all in the Central, Colorado, Minnesota, and Dallas. And so I think Minnesota, who needs to win now, either this year or next year, Billy Guerin listened to John Hines, who earlier in the week said this team was soft, and he went out and he added all grit players. I didn't get a chance to go to the game last night here at T-Mobile against the Knights. I did get to watch it on TV. This Minnesota team is for real. And we have made a bet already that the Dallas Stars will lose in the first round. That's a future bet. Likely Minnesota and Dallas will meet in the first round. That's a bet that Minnesota will beat them. Or should Minnesota catch Colorado, a bet that the Avalanche would beat the Stars in the first round. That was a wild game last night as well. Stars led 4-1 at one point early in the second against the Avalanche, and Avalanche come back, tie the game with the empty net, and win in overtime 5-4 to break Dallas's 10-game winning streak, although they still picked up a point last night. Wild absolutely dominated the Golden Knights, who continued to struggle, and we're in a Malinsky spot off a long road trip, the first game back home, 4-2 here. That was a cheap price. I hope our listeners out there on Palm Saturdays were on that game last night. Some things that surprised me. Goalies that did not get moved. Jordan Bennington. In digging further here, he has so many teams in a no-trade clause. He couldn't have been moved to Edmonton. He had a no-trade clause with Edmonton. The only Canadian team he could have been moved to was Toronto, and they were sellers. So he did not get moved. I thought off his performance in the Olympics, this was the sell-high time for the Blues on Jordan Bennington, and I think they're pretty happy with Joel Hofer moving forward as their number one goalie. And then I thought Sergei Bobrovsky would get moved by the Panthers. He's 37. He's expecting them to sign him to another long-term contract. He wants 6 years. There's no way the Panthers are going to sign him to a long-term contract. Now would have been the time to move him. I thought Edmonton still needs to answer the questions in goal. They made the trade with Pittsburgh. It's worked out for Pittsburgh. Hasn't necessarily worked out for Edmonton. They didn't move. And the Golden Knights, who have 3 goalies, but none of them have been good enough really to win in the playoffs. Schmidt got beat last night. Aiden Hill has not been terrific really since his Stanley Cup run. So some trades that were made and some trades that weren't made. Is there anything really actionable here? I still believe in Minnesota. I still believe Minnesota's got a real puncher's chance against the Avalanche and that they are better than Dallas. It's just a shame that they're in that central division and you can't parlay their success further down the road. They're going to have their probably face their toughest matchup in the second round. Let's talk briefly about the NHL card today, and we'll get more into college basketball when we talk to Ben Wilson after the break. Here's one rant for me, though. This ABC, and you can say Disney and ESPN or whatever, they're into this Saturday doubleheader, right? Every week now, Central Time, you get the 11:30 game, and then you get the 2 o'clock game. Once again this week, three out of the four teams not in playoff contention. They don't have this. They set this schedule. They have no flexibility with it. Rangers, Devils at noon Pacific, 2 o'clock Central, 3 o'clock. Who cares? Totally irrelevant game. I mean, in terms of general viewership. Capitals, Bruins has some interest early at 11:30. And then you look at what TNT does and how they flex their schedule. What do they have as their game tomorrow? Wild at Avalanche. Like the game of the week, and they've got it on TNT, and we get stuck on ABC with these games that have little national interest for certain. So when we look at the card today, I know the Sabres are a big price, but I think you have to keep continuing to lay it. This team has just answered every call. How about the Holy Trinity that they just completed? Go to Florida and win in a really hard-fought game in Sunrise in South Florida, where they're all in the third period and tied, and then the next afternoon come back and play Tampa, and oh, by the way, go up 5-0 on the number one team in the East, the Tampa Bay Lightning, and then come and beat the Golden Knights two nights later. Well, now they'll host Nashville. You know, there's a real possibility the Sabres could be the one seed in the East. I did have to take them at 10-1 to win the East to hedge my Tampa Bay positions moving forward. They are laying $1.80 today against the Predators in Buffalo, total 6.5. You could look at the puck line here at +120, but I have laid the price already with the Sabres today. I looked at the Lightning game today at Toronto. Toronto, three teams are really in a free fall, and I got stung last night by Florida. They win at Detroit, still a young team, the Red Wings, but Florida, Vancouver, and Toronto are bet against. I can't lay this price on the road, however, with the Lightning, who are struggling right now. I played the Canadiens tonight. They're plus at LA against the Kings. That game will go off at 6 o'clock Central Time, +105. They're off the back-to-back here. The Kings team got a little boost from firing Jim Hiller, but I think the dead coach bounce is going to wrap up here. All right, when we come back after the break, we'll talk to my friend Ben Wilson, exciting up-and-coming play-by-play voice. You can hear him on Fox Sports 1. You can hear him on ESPN Plus and many different venues. That's next after the break on Palm Saturdays here on 104.3 The Score.
We're back with more Palm Saturdays, starring Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm, live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Presented by Circa Sports. Sports betting the way it should be, with no bet fees, on 104.3 The Score.
Welcome back into Palm Saturdays, and joining us on the Circa Sports Illinois Hotline, it's my friend Ben Wilson. Ben, thank you for getting up early from your family's palatial estate in La Jolla to join us here on The Score.
You know what, Mike? On a day where we have some outstanding Bundesliga action kicking off in 7 minutes or so, I would not pass up the opportunity to make my debut on your wonderful show. Thank you so much for thinking of me.
I knew you'd be up betting soccer early. Ben, next week you're going to be calling the WAC tournament from the Orleans in Las Vegas. As our listeners know, Chicago State was part of the WAC for about a decade before they went independent and then joined the Northeastern Conference. Any insights into who you think from a betting perspective will come out on top in the WAC?
Yeah, it's a fascinating tournament in large part because there's only seven teams left. This is, unfortunately for us, the final year of the WAC. They're about to merge with the A-Sun. And of the seven teams left, Mike, nobody has ever won the tournament. So this used to be the Grand Canyon Invitational, so to speak. New Mexico State dominated for a stretch. Those teams are now gone. Utah Valley is pretty clearly the most complete team. And what's sort of fascinating is they're in the middle of this lawsuit right now against the conference where they did not pay an exit fee. They're leaving the conference next year as the whole conference, you know, is basically in flux right now. And so there was this whole back and forth of whether they'd even be eligible. They actually were just yesterday granted an injunction to play in the tournament, and they are going to be the number one seed. This is a conference where the top two seeds get double byes here all the way to the semifinals. So they should be the favorite. They're a team that's been rock solid as far as their defensive efficiency, yet they've really been snake bitten in this tournament. They've had four or five just heartbreaking losses deep in the WAC tournament. It would be kind of poetic for, you know, to me, Mike, for them to finally get over the hump and win this thing. Having said that, they are the favorite. I know this is a tournament where people are largely going to want to take a look at a deeper shot here, but it is a league that, to me, it's Utah Valley's to lose more than anything.
Ben, you grew up in Wisconsin. The Badgers certainly are an interesting team this year. They've had some tremendous highs and some mind-numbing lows at times, but they certainly have a high ceiling. They've won both in Champaign and at Chrysler Arena in Ann Arbor. Today they go to another tough venue, Mackey Arena. That game's going to tip at 3 o'clock Central Time on CBS. Badgers lost by double digits at home earlier in the year to Matt Painter's Boilermakers. They're catching 8.5 today. Your thoughts on Wisconsin-Purdue?
Yeah, it's fascinating too, because when they, you know, when they met at the Kohl Center back in early January, I mean, we were thinking Purdue was this wagon that was at the time, I think the Boilermakers had only lost once, right, to Iowa State. And since then, we've certainly seen a much different looking Purdue team. I think for Wisconsin, I mean, it's a situation where, as you're right, Mike, with how the highs have been, they're going to be very matchup dependent come NCAA tournament time. I look at a game like today, and you know, I do see an avenue for success just to at least, you know, to be live from a shooting perspective, because of I think more the deficiencies on the Purdue defensive side. And it's a Purdue team that, I mean, they give up so many threes. They give up a ton of good looks for three as well. And, you know, it's a thing for Wisconsin where they're going to take a ton of threes, and they've been, I think, smart analytically with how they've tried to attack these games this year. It's just a matter of the shooting has been inconsistent. I don't know that the actual skill position players they have are the complete right guys to fit Greg Gard's scheme, similar to, you know, I should say in contrast to last year where they had John Tanjay, who was a great shooter overall, but after that you just didn't really ever feel like there was consistency behind him. So that to me has kind of plagued the Badgers at times this year. But if anything, I would more look at it at an over, even though we know that Purdue likes to play a slower tempo. They do have the game at home that generally, you know, that sort of tempo generally favors the teams who are playing on their home floor. But just given the shooting for Wisconsin, I do see them being able to score. They have been very, very susceptible themselves on the defensive end. So it looks like, you know, 155.5. That's a fair number to me. But I do see this being a game that you could easily see a game played in the high 70s, low 80s here.
A game that I'm looking at tonight, now this is going to tip at 11:30 Central Time from Provo, is Texas Tech at BYU. Look, I thought you could draw a line through Texas Tech when Toppin went down for the year. They went to Ames. They're the only team that's won, beaten Iowa State on the road. They beat BYU back on January 17th in Lubbock. Remember, BYU, I think, only had two losses at the time, and Texas Tech was just a 2.5-point favorite. They beat them 84-71. I can't get over how bad a form BYU is in. They lost 97-84 to Central Florida at Provo, 79-71 at West Virginia, and then just got boat raced 90-68 at Cincinnati. Texas Tech opened a 1.5-point favorite. Right now they're catching 1.5 tonight. Thoughts on Texas Tech and BYU? I think Grant McCausland's one of the top three or four coaches in the country, Ben.
No, I agree. I generally am a guy, even you mentioned, even with the injury at the top, and he's a guy I'm certainly going to look to back more often than not. And I mean, from the perspective of BYU, and my general thought this time of year when you're looking at value and teams you want to be on or against, it might not seem sexy, but the teams that play, you know, lockdown defense that are able to force turnovers, are just really pains, you know, thorns in the side to try to get good looks against. Those are the sorts of teams I want to bet on. And you know, BYU right now, for as good as they've been, and certainly with A.J. DeBonta, you know, had just a tremendous scoring season as a freshman, and you know, it'll be a good debate over whether he ends up going number one this summer in the draft. But they just don't play defense consistently enough for me to ever really feel confident in backing BYU. I mean, turnover-wise, they barely force any. They're not a team that really makes you feel pressure. You know, they don't commit a lot of fouls. That's because they give up a lot of pretty easy looks in the paint and give up a lot of threes as well. So that's the sort of recipe where even if you're Texas Tech and you're losing your best player, you still feel good from an offensive perspective. You know, it's a great three-point shooting team, and that was not really JT Toppin's strength. I mean, he was a 28% three-point shooter before he went down. There are a lot of other guys. I mean, Christian Anderson's having a great shooting year from the outside, Donovan Atwell. So this is certainly a matchup, Mike, to your point, where the things that Texas Tech loses by not having Toppin out there might not necessarily get exposed in a matchup like this at BYU, even though they are going on the road in a generally tough place to play. So I'm with you, and we've seen the market come down a little bit. Even though there were the initial flip, I think we're starting to see some buyback coming here on Texas Tech. So I would not mind at all jumping in, especially now that there are some 2.5s out there before this thing comes back the other way.
You're listening to Palm Saturdays here on 104.3 The Score. Our guest is Ben Wilson. Ben, one of the sports you also call is college baseball. Any early season thoughts on teams that may be flying under the radar in terms of advancing to the College World Series or winning it?
Yeah, I'll tell you, Mike, with the way the college baseball and the coverage has grown, I think there's a ton of betting interest, which is awesome. In the past, it used to just be whatever the odds were, it would just purely reflect the preseason top 25. And it was not uncommon for the odds to literally not change for the first month and a half of the year. There just wasn't, people just weren't talking about it. There wasn't as much interest, which was great for us as bettors. And for me, I cover a lot of the early season tournaments. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily the case now. I think there's a little bit more attention being paid on that stuff. But I will say, a team that really popped to me that I saw opening weekend that is absolutely legit. They're a team that produced Cade Horton, who I saw in college a few years ago, now having a great career for the Cubs. They're a pitching factory with Skip Johnson. Is Oklahoma, and they were not even ranked to start the year. But from watching them, and you never want to overreact to one weekend, but they are the sort of team that has got a lot of depth pitching wise. They can absolutely mash at the plate. So I took a piece of them at 50-1. I mean, they're still out there 30-1. I think that's pretty solid value for a team that to me is pretty clearly a top 10 squad. And that's still a pretty fair number. And I'm just looking at DraftKings, but shop around. There are certainly books that, especially that are newer to market, that might not have really caught on to, especially in Illinois, maybe depending on the sort of action they're getting, maybe you don't see an adjustment at some of your local books there. And maybe you can get a longer price. But Oklahoma is the first team that jumps out to me as a squad that I 100% expect to be right in the mix with the LSUs, UCLAs, Texases of the world, who are all your short shots right now.
Yeah, I'm impressed, Ben, out there in San Diego. You're following the Score lineup here as you teased Cade Horton, who's going to join David Haw and Bruce Levine inside the clubhouse in the show that follows this. Let's talk some Major League Baseball and your Brewers. They won 97 games last year. Currently at circa over-under is 84.5 wins. Cubs, again, the solid favorite to win the Central. Your thoughts on Brewers and Cubs?
Look, I think Milwaukee's going to be just fine, even though they lose Freddie Peralta. And, we don't know the timeline yet on Quinn Priester coming back. I think from a hitting perspective, I really don't have any concerns about Milwaukee from an offensive perspective this year, even though they really didn't add much. I think outside of losing Caleb Durbin, they're in a really good position. And with Pat Murphy, I mean, as much as people are going to think about what they saw last, which was just an absolute obliteration in the NLCS last year, it's sort of set up to be a great regular season team. I mean, Pat Murphy, to me, is the perfect manager for this team. He's the best manager in baseball by a long shot. And for the Brewers, you're talking a win total in the mid-80s. It's a team I fully expect to be – I don't expect them to win 97 for sure. And, the biggest question is going to be Brandon Woodruff's health. Jacob Mizorowski's ability to be stretched out as an actual full season starter. But I mean, now they've got Brandon Sproat, Jet Williams are going to play big roles, who they got from the Mets, who are outstanding prospects in the Freddy Peralta trade. It was smart to sell high like they did on Peralta. Brewers are going to be fine. I would firmly have them rock solid and, you know, in the upper 80s as far as wins goes. And well, I think the Cubs probably have to be the favorites. I think once again, you know, you're looking at a situation where I'd probably more rate these teams basically dead even though on paper, sure, Cubs look more impressive, but again, there's a lot of question marks. And yeah, I was interested, Mike, to see the, you know, Cade Horton, I think his ERA over under is like 4.04, if you want to bet that, and that's evenly juiced for, you know, for a guy who was so good last year. It was a little surprising to me, but I think he's got to answer a lot of questions of, you know, the analytics and sabermetrics suggested he got a little fortunate last year, and I love his arsenal. It's just, you know, will we see major league hitters make that adjustment to him this year, and will he have the same sort of success another go around? So I'm obviously, I like what I see Cubs, you know, on the Cubs lineup front, and bringing in Alex Bregman should be a really nice addition. At the same time, I just wouldn't sleep on Milwaukee. Like, they're a team infrastructure-wise. They're never going to look sexy on paper. But as far as making bets against them, you kind of do that at your own peril, at least in the regular season. Postseason is generally when you want to fade Milwaukee, because that's when the lack of true elite skill set is exposed in general.
This is a market I have not seen, Ben, but I'm going to throw this question out there to you. Which Cubs starter will have the most wins in 2026?
Ooh, that's a great question. You know, I think it's funny, because as much as I would, like, I don't know that, yeah, I think Horton to me, and he was a double-digit guy last year, I certainly understand why people are expecting him to take a step back, and I'm weirdly tempted to, I would almost be tempted to take a long shot if they priced this on Jameson Taillon, even though he's had injury issues and was up and down last year, more so because, you know, he's sort of a guy that, honestly, I felt like in the biggest moments last year when they really needed him was kind of a consistent guy that really kind of steadied the ship for the Cubs. And if you could convince me he was going to stay healthy, you know, it's a team that's going to get a lot of run support. So I think from just a pure handicapping the wins, like, I wouldn't look at it as the actual best pitcher. There's a world where you could see Taillon gets a, you know, double-digit wins here if he's able to, you know, stay out there, make 30 starts. And I think the way, with how he didn't pitch that much last year, I'd actually think, you know, normally you have guys who went deep into the postseason. I'm very skeptical about them coming back to the next year. Taillon is probably the, you know, one guy on that staff that sort of bucks the trend, where he really didn't pitch a ton of big time innings until they got him back for the stretch run last year. So that would kind of be my oddball, maybe long shot answer to that.
All right, Ben, let's close with this. You're an everyday tennis bettor, a huge fan of the sport. I respect your opinion. Thoughts on the men and women's side at Indian Wells?
Look, I was up watching Alex Ayala last night till that was what, after midnight on Central Time. Look, I think today it's interesting because on the men's side, and I'll just look at a specific match. You know, Novak Djokovic, he's certainly been, he's been rolling. But I would say do not look past this young Polish tennis player, Kamil Majszak, who I've been super impressed by. I love how his game translates to all surfaces. He's taking on Djokovic today. I'm just trying to pull up what the current prices, but in these best of three matches at Indian Wells, where you have a very slow surface relative to the hard court game, you tend to see some upsets. I mean, we just saw Lorenzo Musetti certainly not look not to be in great form coming back from injury. He goes down pretty comfortably. So this is generally a tournament that provides some upsets. And I mean, this is, you know, my shot's like 7-1. I don't expect him necessarily to win, but I think he can push Djokovic. I'd look for to go over on games in this match, which is going to be set in the teens, or to win a set, you can get a big plus price. There are guys like that, that, and I think last year it was like Arthur Fies, who's another really good player on this sort of surface, made a big impression here. So I'm trying to look out for some of those players that are a little bit more unheralded, who, you know, have an opportunity with the right draw to make a run here. And that's one player in Majszak who I would just say, kind of, you know, mark him down. Maybe he doesn't win today against Djokovic, but that's the perfect sort of player to target in some of these events that are not necessarily Grand Slams, but Masters of Thousands, on the right surface, on the right day, things can certainly work in a player like that's favor. And I expect him to give Djokovic a pretty good test today.
Ben, final question, and I'm going to move to the women's side. Do you have any concerns moving forward with the big Belarusian Arina Sabalenka getting engaged to an arms dealer, masquerading around as a health feud titan? Let me correct that, alleged arms dealer.
Thank you. It's great because the second I turned on Tennis Channel yesterday, it's her doing the interview on the desk, and they just do the tight shot of her ring, and they would not stop showing the ring. It was great. Sabalenka, it's one of those things. I loved betting on her when she was still trying to figure out the service yips and was a clear, not even number two to Iga Swiatek, but was. It was more like a three or a four to an Elena Rybakina, and was just clearly not yet there mentally. I think to me now, like, her game is incredibly complete. The mental part of it has always been her own worst enemy, right? And we see now that when she's at her best, she's clearly the number one in the world. Yet, the inconsistencies have been pretty glaring, and she's always struggled at Indian Wells. I don't know that I'd be, even though she's looked solid so far, it's not a great surface for her. I probably wouldn't be backing her just because of the price now. I mean, with Iga Swiatek coming back down to earth and having struggled for the last couple of years, you just don't get the sort of secondary pricing on Sabalenka that you used to. And as a big-time favorite, it's why I didn't really bet on Iga a ton when she was at the big of her powers, because the market had her valued so highly. It's kind of the same thing now. And yet you still do see, it's weird, from time to time, for as great as Sabalenka is, sometimes the service issues do rear their ugly head and still kind of get in the way. And we saw that in the Australian Open final against Elena Rybakina, where she just kind of melted down. So it's more just an interesting thing to watch going forward. And, you kind of have to start setting the over-unders at, like, I don't know, 8.5 shots of the ring every time she is anywhere near an interview room.
That's a 12-carat diamond engagement ring. Very few could afford it. Certainly the Wilson family could. Ben, thank you for taking the time on an early Saturday morning out in California to join us here in Chicago. When we come back, we'll close out the show with my best bets in college basketball and a final farewell to Coach Lou Holtz. It's Palm Saturdays here on 104.3 The Score.
We're back with more Palm Saturdays, starring Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm, live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Presented by Circa Sports. Sports betting the way it should be, with no bet fees, on 104.3 The Score.
Welcome back into Palm Saturdays. I'm Mike Palm, Vice President of Operations for Circa, the D in Golden Gate, and Circa Sports. So certainly some sad news to report. The Blackhawks announced just a few minutes ago of the passing of Troy Murray, or as many of you know him as the radio color analyst for WGN Radio. He was drafted in the third round in 1980 by the Blackhawks and spent 12 of his 15 seasons with the team. 1986, he won the Selke Award as the NHL's best defensive forward when he had a career-high 99 points. He was the president of the Blackhawks Alumni Association and one of the most beloved Hawks of all time. Rest in peace, Troy Murray. Best bets college basketball today. We're going to give you three. Just want to mention, I don't ever remember seeing a Duke North Carolina game with a line of 17.5. Obviously, Caleb Wilson out with a broken thumb, done for the season. He had 23 in the first meeting when the Tar Heels came back from the dead to steal that game from Duke. A 17.5 they're laying. That's up from 16.5 from yesterday. Okay, I mentioned it earlier. My best bet is Texas Tech tonight at BYU. I just can't get over the form BYU has been playing with and how good Tech has been since Toppin went down. The money going against me here in this game, with BYU currently favored by 1.5 here at Circa, I'm going to take Tech in the 1.5 tonight in Provo. That's a late tip, 9:30 Central Time, 7:30 Pacific. Earlier in the day, another team in bad form. I was in Tucson Monday night to see Iowa State play, and boy, what a disappointing game that was. I didn't think Arizona even played well and easily won that game. Iowa State was not looking to step into their threes, and that's the one area you could exploit, the Wildcats. So I'll take 15.5 with an Arizona State team that seems to have a little bit of of kick left to them at the end of the season here heading into the Big 12 tournament. That's a lot of points. That'll tip at 1 o'clock on FS1. And this train that is the University of Florida, boy, did they struggle in November and December. But you could certainly make the argument they've been the best team in the country the last 6 weeks. They beat Kentucky 92-83 on Valentine's Day. Now they go to Rupp Arena. You have to lay the 6.5. Look in the market. You can find a 6 right now. I lay 6 with Florida. That game will tip at 3 o'clock Central on ESPN. So those are the three best bets today. Arizona State plus 15.5. Florida minus 6, and Texas Tech plus 1.5. I attended the University of Notre Dame, and my football coach during my entire tenure there was Lou Holtz. Coach Holtz passed away earlier this week at the age of 89. He'd been in hospice for over a month, maybe 6 weeks, so we thought the end was near. In my time at Notre Dame, I never missed an opportunity to hear Lou Holtz speak. He is the most dynamic public speaker, the most inspirational public speaker that I've ever been around. And I've been around a few. I make it a point to try to go and listen to people that energize me and that I respect. On the sports side of it, I've listened to Tommy Lasorda, listened to Bart Giamani, great speakers. On the politics side, Pat Buchanan had an opportunity about a year ago to listen to President Trump when he had his event here at Circa when he announced the policy on no taxes on tips. But Lou Holtz was something special and on a whole nother level. You know, every Saturday home game, they would have a luncheon on Fridays in South Bend, and Coach Holtz would speak, and of course at the pep rallies as well. But I would always make it a point, if I could, to try to attend these luncheons because, I mean, he just talked to you about life and about excellence and about responsibilities and about commitments and a framework to live by. And, you know, here's a guy, a small guy, grew up in a small town, the father with a third grade education, you know, and he always had a new story. You know, he said, I knew I had plenty to eat because every time I'd ask my dad for seconds, he said, you've already had plenty. You know, he always had those stories and that inspiration. I wanted you to listen just to one. This is Coach Holtz speaking about the principles in life.
Life is nothing more than making good choices. You choose new drugs, drop out of school, join a gang, get tattoos, get arrested, you choose to have difficulty in life, and stop blaming me. So all I tried to do was teach our children, teach our athletes how to make good choices.
Right.
And the best way to make good choices is follow three simple rules. And I'm an old man. My birthday candles cost more than a cake, but I've never needed a fourth rule. Rule number one is do what's right. Never right time do the wrong thing. Never wrong time do the right thing. If you have any doubt about what's right or wrong, get out the Bible. You do the right thing, you're going to build trust with other people. When you have trust, you can have a relationship. My wife and I have been married together 116 years, 58 apiece, but together 168, because we can trust one another. That's why it's important just to always do the right thing. Rule number two. If you'll do everything to the very best of your ability, not because somebody's looking, not because somebody's going to applaud you, it's just the way you live. Mm-hmm. And the last thing, and the most important thing, is let people know you genuinely care. Everybody you're going to meet has a problem, has a difficulty, needs a kind word, a smile, and encouragement. Mm-hmm. Why do we wait for somebody to have a difficulty in their life? Or why don't we tell people how much they mean to us? Mm-hmm. And just like you tell your children, you may be president, you may end up in jail or somewhere in between, but there are three things never going to change. You're always going to be my child. I'm always going to love you. And I'm always going to be here for you. And don't ever forget that.
You know, Mike Greenberg tells the story about going to interview Coach Holtz, and Greenberg's wife was expecting their first child, and him telling Greenberg, the greatest thing you can do for your children is to show them how much you love their mother each and every day. And it's a fabulous, fabulous lesson. He came to Notre Dame at a low point, at least a low point at the end of the century. Remember, the beating they took at the hands of Jimmy Johnson and Jerry Faust's last game. And Jerry Faust, what a nice man. I met Jerry Faust, just a really beautiful human being, but you know, and a great career at Cincinnati Moeller, the Catholic high school in Cincinnati. State championship after state championship. It was overwhelmed at Notre Dame. And Miami ran the score up on them, you know. And I remember Ara Parseghian was in studio with Brent Musburger at CBS on the game, you know. And he talked about, you know, you should have a little more respect for a guy in their last game than to run up the score. And, you know, they ran a fake punt. And Jimmy Johnson argues, obviously, that they had their third-teamers in there and they were still scoring. And it wasn't his fault. It was Notre Dame's fault. But that was a low point. And they were able to hire Lou Holtz. It's very interesting. I remember growing up, I remember him coaching Arkansas. I remember him at Minnesota. He had in his contract at Minnesota that he could take the Notre Dame job if it became available. That was the only job. As long as he had taken Minnesota to a bowl game, and he had. And so he was able to take the job, a national championship in 1988, and finish second two more times in his tenure. New Year's Day bowl game every year after that national championship year. Coach Holtz, may the angels lead you into paradise. May the martyrs greet you at your arrival and lead you to the holy city, the new and eternal Jerusalem. Stay tuned to The Score. Up next, David Hahn, Bruce Levine. It's Inside the Clubhouse.